Great. Well, thank you, Dave, and it's a pleasure to be here to talk to this group this morning. What I'm going to do now is shift to from the virus cell interaction to the patient-clinician interaction. And what I'm going to focus on in the next 30 minutes is really the issue of how you decide whether or not to treat a patient today. And as you'll hear later this afternoon and throughout the day, this is a highly dynamic period of time in which our options for treatment are rapidly evolving. In other words, something that may have made sense a year ago may no longer be the best course of action for an individual patient. So that's what I'm going to focus on, who to treat and when to treat them. Learning objectives, those are also in front of you. I won't read them now. First question. So this is your quiz, as you know from Dr. Schooley's experience, that you will be asked this again, and we hope to see a learning curve, if you will. So which of the following adverse effect is associated with both telaprevir and bocevivir, the two first-generation protease inhibitors? Choice number one, alopecia. Number two, hematuria. Number three, anemia. Number four, rash. And number five, neutropenia. So pick the one answer that is linked to both telaprevir and bocevivir. Go ahead and vote. Okay. So 56% said anemia, and then the rest along rash and neutropenia. And we'll come back to that. So I'll start with a patient, a 55-year-old man who has hypertension and type 2 diabetes. He was evaluated after applying for life insurance. He wanted to increase his policy. And life insurance companies have been screening more aggressively for hepatitis C than clinicians for a number of years now. And they found him to have a normal ALT, although we can argue whether an ALT of 43 is truly normal. Many would suggest for men it should be less than 30 and for women less than 20. His hepatitis C antibody is reactive. He had been completely unaware of this diagnosis. So he fits into this category of baby boomers who are undiagnosed. After a direct questioning, it turns out he did inject drugs very early in his life, but of course he does not consider himself an injection drug user. This was literally three or four times with some friends, so clearly this hadn't come up in discussions. Now, the first thing he did was go on the internet, and the second thing he did is buy some milk thistle, and he's been taking milk thistle. I'll pause to comment that there is a study paid for by the NIH, the Complementary Alternative Medicine Branch, did a placebo-controlled trial of milk thistle and showed over a one-year period no difference in serum ALT between placebo and Silymarin and no difference in viral parameters. In other words, milk thistle was not better than placebo. So I generally tell my patients not to take milk thistle, and I encourage them if they want to take something natural that's been shown to lower ALT, that coffee may be the preferred alternative. But the real question is that should he take treatment with peginterferon, ribavirin, and a first-generation protease inhibitor? That's why he's in the office today. And it's also clear that he doesn't want to be hepatitis C infected. I've yet to meet a patient where the question is, should I just stay infected the rest of my life? It's more, should I take this treatment today with its attendant side effects? So as we get into that, I want to talk about the benefits of treatment. So first, let's look at why we're concerned about hepatitis C. Well, this was a very interesting study that came out of Taiwan, HCV Reveal. It piggybacked on a previous study of hepatitis B, and it followed more than 23,000 adults with and without hepatitis C. And then among those hepatitis C antibody positive, there were some that were RNA detectable, that is, chronically infected, and some that had antibody and presumably cleared. What you see over to your left is the risk of hepatic death, the incidence of hepatic mortality over a period that spanned more than a decade. And the cumulative mortality rate was 12.8% for those infected. So not surprisingly, hepatitis C leads to liver disease. Now, what was also interesting in this study is to your right, which is non-hepatic mortality. And you can see that the viremic patients were substantially more likely to die of other causes compared to those antibody negative and those antibody positive but virus negative. Now, many studies that look at mortality among hepatitis C patients are heavily confounded by injection drug use. In this population in Taiwan, that confounding was not such a factor. They went on to look at the specific causes of death. Not surprisingly, the risk of liver-related death and hepatocellular carcinoma, the multivariate adjusted hazard ratio was 12, and for HCC, it was 21.6. But if you look at death related to diabetes, cardiovascular, and kidney disease, we see that hepatitis C led to an increased hazard ratio for death from diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and kidney disease. So the question is this a sort of true and unrelated phenomenon, or is hepatitis C playing a role? Well, to try to answer that, I want to look at some of the data that's emerging on what happens when you cure the infection. Now, I could have selected from a number of studies showing the hepatitis C cure leads to improved clinical outcomes. This was published in JAMA last summer. It's from a European group that looked at 530 adults followed for 8.4 years following treatment, looking at all-cause mortality as well as liver-related mortality or transplant. You can see that patients with sustained virologic response were substantially less likely to die and substantially less likely to have liver-related death or liver transplant compared to those treated with no SVR. This fits into a number of studies all suggesting that viral cure improves liver-related outcomes. But I'm going to go through a series of studies that gets to these extrahepatic manifestations, and I'll grant you that this is not as well established. But there is a strong link between hepatitis C and the development of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, typically B-cell lymphomas. So this study, taken from Japan, looked at a cohort of individuals with hepatitis C and looked at the incidence of lymphoma among those who achieved sustained virologic response and those with persistent infection. And over time, you can see patients that achieved SVR were less likely to develop incident B-cell lymphomas in this Japanese cohort, suggesting the virus may be behind some of the B-cell malignancies we see in this patient population. I also mentioned the issue of increased diabetes deaths. Well, this is a study looking at the relationship of incident type 2 diabetes and chronic hepatitis C, with and without SVR. And this looks at Japanese patients, again, who were non-diabetic, who underwent treatment. And it looks at three different categories of risk: older than 50, cirrhotics, and pre-diabetics. In each group, treatment of hepatitis C leading to SVR decreased the risk of developing diabetes in that patient population. Now, it could be other factors, such as weight loss or other manifestations lowering the risk of diabetes, but there is a body of literature to suggest that hepatitis C is linked to the development of type 2 diabetes, and this study suggests eradication of the virus may lower the risk of developing diabetes. Now, I also showed you data from the REVEAL study in Taiwan that hepatitis C was linked to cardiovascular disease. Well, what's the risk there? Maybe it's excess smoking. But there's some interesting study, and this was just published in the Journal of Hepatology, and there's a number of studies like this. This looked at myocardial perfusion using a thallium scan. And what it showed is the hepatitis C patients compared to control patients had abnormal myocardial perfusion using thallium. Now, these were not clinical situation. There wasn't a myocardial infarction, but their perfusion was decreased. This study looks at patients who were treated and had an SVR to your left. In the middle is treatment and followed by relapse, and the right is non-response. What they saw was that SVR led to a reversal, in the case of SVR, a permanent reversal of myocardial perfusion defects, suggesting there may be benefits there as well. And what about neurocognitive effects? This has been a relatively controversial area. This is a study that's also just been published in Hepatology that looked at neurocognitive testing. This study shows vigilance and working memory, a number of other parameters assessed. They were assessed before interferon ribavirin, during interferon ribavirin, and after. At baseline, the two groups with and without SVR were very similar. During treatment, everyone's brain worked a little less well on interferon, but after treatment, the surprise is that those with SVR had improved parameters of neurocognitive function, including here of vigilance and working memory. In contrast, the people who failed to respond, exposed to interferon, had no change in their neurocognitive function, suggesting that there may be effects of the brain, perhaps through inflammation. And the last category is the effect of hepatitis C cure on fatigue. And this is one thing we know for sure, is when patients complete a course of antiviral therapy and are successful, they feel better. Now, we can argue whether they feel better because of a psychological effect or a physical effect, but the studies are pretty clear that achievement of SVR leads to a improvement in how one rates their fatigue level. So there are certainly benefits of antiviral therapy that perhaps extend beyond the liver disease. Now, part of the reason why I mention this is right now, interferon and ribavirin prevent us from delivering therapy broadly. We're not going to treat someone to prevent diabetes in the future or improve their neurocognitive function. In fact, we'll decrease their neurocognitive function with interferon. But I would suggest that as treatment gets easier to deliver and more effective, we may start to be talking more about these extrahepatic potential benefits of treatment. So some food for thought. But the real question is, if treatment is so beneficial, why have so few patients been cured? Well, the current treatment that we'll discuss has an SVR rate of 75%. In other words, 3 of every 4 people that qualify and take interferon, ribavirin, and clapyrobosefir can be cured. The treatment is telaprevir every 8 hours with 20 grams of fat plus peg interferon ribavirin or bosefavir every 8 hours with a light snack. But if you look to your right, this is data taken from Scott Holmberg's piece in New England Journal of Medicine very recently. You start with 3.2 million Americans that are thought to be chronically infected. We talked in just the last session about 50% being diagnosed. If you go all the way to the bottom, they suggest that 7 to 11% have undergone treatment and roughly 5% have been cured. In other words, if you look at the 3.2 million Americans, today there's been at most 200,000 who've been successfully cured. And these data are true in almost every treatment population. In other words, although we cure as many as 75% of those who actually take treatment, the vast majority in this so-called treatment cascade fall off very early. So many of you have seen a treatment cascade for HIV disease. Here, the big drop-off, 50%, occurs just in diagnosis. The next big drop-off occurs in referral to expert care. Then there's a drop-off when one faces liver biopsy, another drop-off when one faces interferon or ribavirin, and then we get to the effect of treatment. You can see the treatment effect is relatively minimal when one puts all these factors in play. Well, let's turn back to the current treatment. Well, the first thing to remember about current triple therapy is that it includes peg interferon and ribavirin. And most people, within their first 5 minutes of searching the internet for hepatitis C treatment, realize that they don't want to take interferon. And interferon does lead to substantial side effects. I do think that many people leave the web thinking that interferon is impossible to take. It's not impossible to take, it's just something you don't want to do. I sometimes compare it to a bit like I live in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. is about 45 miles away. And if you had to walk there along I-95, you could do it. You wouldn't like it very much. And if it were a hot day like it is now, 96 degrees and humid, about halfway there, you'd say to yourself, why am I doing this? This doctor must be insane. I should be taking a bus or taking a train. But if you just keep plodding along, you can do interferon. That's most people. But the vast majority of people don't want to walk to D.C. in 96-degree humid temperature. They would prefer to take oral therapy that lasts 12 weeks. But the point is, they can do it if they need to. Now, there are issues of drug interactions, and we'll certainly touch on those a bit later, so I won't focus on those. And the efficacy has not been firmly established in the context of HIV and organ transplant. I would say that in ESLD, if you wait until the patient is symptomatic and the second-year medical student knows they have liver failure, you've waited too long and you can't use interferon and ribavirin. Now, you might be able to use oral therapies, and we'll hear more about those. Now, the treatment course is either 24 or 28 weeks or 48 weeks. And it yields, in this response-guided fashion, SVR rates between 66 and 75%. There is no question that the first-generation direct-acting antivirals were a major advance in hepatitis C treatment, 30% over peg ribavirin plus placebo. But it's worth noting that at least half the patients had to take therapy for 48 weeks in some of these studies. We'll get into that a bit. So one of the things I want you to think about is that if you started someone on triple therapy today with telaprobosefir plus peg interferon or ribavirin, and they had to be treated for 48 weeks, about a, let's round up to a year to make the math simple, they would finish their course of therapy in June of 2014. Now, let's assume the FDA approves sofosbuvir, peg interferon, and ribavirin for 12 weeks for genotype 1. And let's assume that's on the market in January of 14. You would start in January, and you would finish in March. In other words, if you waited 6 months, you would finish 3 months earlier in a 12-week course of therapy. So the math suggests that you really have to think hard about whether you start treatment today, because it could be as long as 48 weeks. You'd like it to be 24, but to achieve a 24-week treatment course, you need to be RNA not detected by week 4 of telaprevir and by week 8 of the boceprevir, peg interferon, and ribavirin regimen. So the calendar, I think, does play a role with these medications on the horizon. Now, one of the things that this treatment does very effectively is improve responses across treatment groups. It is worth pointing out, though, that you can create patients, if you will, that respond better. Those with minimal liver fibrosis. Those with more advanced disease tend to respond less well. African-American patients respond less well. Genotype 1 subtype A, because of a lower barrier to the emergence of resistant variant, respond a bit less well. And patients with higher viral loads respond less well. So one could put together these factors. And in fact, for boceprevir, there was a multivariate model that was created that ranked these factors in terms of predicting SVR. So at baseline, viral load, high or low, IL-28B, CC better than T alleles, were all associated with response. Cirrhosis, non-cirrhotic patients, the odds ratio was 4.3. 1B better than 1A, non-black versus black, non-black being better, and BMI, less than 30, also came out in this model. So you can put together patients who are likely to respond. The other thing the boceprevir paradigm taught us is by starting with peg interferon ribavirin for the first 4 weeks, you can assess how someone will do. Now, this breaks it down by the week 4 RNA response, less than 1 log or more than 1 log. Less than 1 log is a poor interferon response, more than 1 log is a good response to interferon, and along the bottom you see CC, CT, and TT. The first thing to note is that nearly all the CC patients have at least a 1 log response. In fact, there were only five patients who took peg interferon and ribavirin and did not have a 1 log response. I'm not even sure they actually took their interferon and ribavirin. But if you look at the CT and TT patients, if you fail to have a 1-log response, the chance of success in the 30% range. On the other hand, with these poor baseline predictors, if you have a 1-log response, it's 80%. And about half the CT and TT patients were more than 1-log, and half were less than 1-log. So if you were to think about treatment today, and your patient has a T allele, one could argue, based on these data, that that 1-log response to peg interferon ribavirin may help you predict who will do better and who will do worse. Now, interferon alpha, I talked earlier about if you do a 1-minute internet search, you'll leave with the idea you don't want to take it. And the reason is that it affects nearly every body's system. This is a figure we put together in a Nature Reviews paper, and it just shows constitutional symptoms, the flu-like symptoms. It can affect the eyes with retinal abnormalities. Patients are increased risk for infections, not because of neutropenia, but probably because of interferon-induced lymphopenia. There's also neuropsychiatric effects, depression, irritability, cognitive dysfunction. There's skin rashes. There's pulmonary events, cough. There's studies showing the DLCO decreases on interferon. There can be autoimmune effects as well as bone marrow suppression across all the cell lines. Interferon really affects nearly every body system. It also is an antiviral agent that affects hepatitis C. Telaprevir and boceprevir, as we know, added to the side effects. Now, if we look at the common adverse event between both telaprevir and boceprevir, this might have been a question we asked earlier, you can see that when one looks at the side effects for telaprevir, rash, anemia, and anorectal symptoms are present. For boceprevir, anemia, dysgeusia, and neutropenia. So the common side effect to both telaprevir and boceprevir in general is anemia. The mechanism of anemia is not well known, but likely represents bone marrow suppression. It's not hemolysis. But the overall regimen, you have peg interferon bone marrow suppression, you have protease inhibitor bone marrow suppression, and you have ribavirin-induced hemolysis. It's a mixed anemia. If one were to use EPO, EPO works by trying to overcome the bone marrow suppression engendered by the interferon as well as clathrin-bocephir. Anorectal symptoms reflect the telaprevir being excreted through the GI tract. If your patient complains of anorectal symptoms, it means they're not taking their telaprevir with enough fat. So go back, revisit the dietary history, and get them to eat more fat with their telaprevir. That will improve the anorectal symptoms. Now, what about the management of anemia? I don't want to get into the details of this, but the lessons learned for anemia management are ribavirin dose reduction is the most critical step for managing anemia. You should reduce the ribavirin early and feel comfortable reducing to as low as 600 milligrams per day, because with anemia, if you fall behind, you can get into trouble using EPO and blood transfusions. This was a randomized controlled trial that showed ribavirin dose reduction and aggressive EPO use led to the same sustained virologic response in patients treated with bocephir peg ribavirin. So reduction is the first step, and it does not appear to decrease the likelihood of SVR. EPO should be reserved to when ribavirin dose reduction fails. Now, what about rash? Well, telaprevir recently got a black box warning because of severe rashes. The ones that we worry about are Stevens-Johnson syndrome and drug rash with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms. And this can be quite serious. The majority of rashes that occur, however, are mild to moderate. Severe rashes involving more than 50% of the body's surface area are less than 5%. But these serious, potentially life-threatening rashes, SJS and DRESS, remind us not to treat through a severe telaprevir rash. This is an indication to discontinue. And on the next slide, there is a discussion of the management. Mild to moderate rashes, you do not need to change your dosing. You can treat with topical corticosteroids, oral antihistamines. People say oatmeal baths work very well. This is not something I've personally tried, but patients tell me oatmeal baths help with the itching and rash of this therapy. If it's a severe rash, more than 50% of the body's surface area, you need to stop telaprevir and see the patient back in 1 week. The other point of this, if you have to measure the body's surface area, it means two things. One, a cell phone photograph will not encompass the entire body surface area, so they need to come into the office, and they need to put a gown on, and you need to examine to find out how much rash there is. But if it's severe, stopping telaprevir will lead to a stabilization, but the resolution of rash actually takes up to 4 to 6 weeks. It's not an overnight phenomenon. If you manage aggressively severe rashes by stopping telaprevir, most patients continue peg interferon and ribavirin. But if you're worried about a severe systemic reaction, you should stop all therapy. In general, oral corticosteroids and systemic corticosteroids do not work for this rash. So I want to move to talk in the remaining few minutes about treatment-experienced patients. This is a different patient. He's got hemophilia. He's got no stigmata, chronic liver disease on exam, although he's had a platelet count of 137,000. And his ultrasound shows a liver with increased echogenicity. EGD showed GERD, but no varices. And he was treated in 06 with a null virologic response. And the question is, should he be treated today with peg interferon, ribavirin, and a first-generation protease inhibitor? Now, I'll comment to say there are some signs here that he may have cirrhosis. One of them is the platelet count of 137,000. In my mind, a hepatitis C-infected patient with a low platelet count is cirrhotic until proven otherwise. So let's look at the definitions. A PEG ribavirin relapser is a patient who took PEG interferon ribavirin, became undetectable, and relapsed after stopping therapy. A partial responder went down by 2 logs, but did not achieve undetectable. And a null responder is someone who never declined more than 2 logs in the first 12 weeks of therapy. That's roughly 25 to 30% of patients treated, and our patient was a null responder. Well, how do these patients do? Well, the study that really, I think, told us how to think about these patients was the REALIZE study. This was telaprevir plus peg interferon and ribavirin. And what this shows is that for relapsers, independent of fibrosis stage, the SVR rate was between 85 and 86%, clearly better than placebo. So relapsers do quite well, including cirrhotic relapsers. Partial responders, we see the impact of fibrosis. No fibrosis or minimal, 72%. Cirrhotic partial responders, 34%. And then if we go to prior null responders, if you look at minimal disease, it's 40%. And among cirrhotic null responders, only 14%. So if we took our patient who I believe has cirrhosis based on his low platelet count, who's a prior null responder, these data would suggest that therapy with telaprevir, peginterferon, or ribavirin would yield a 14% likelihood of SVR. The other thing we need to talk about with both this patient and the prior cirrhotic null responder is what's coming. Now, my job is not to cover all of what's coming. We'll spend the whole afternoon on that topic. But in my mind, if I'm going to talk to a patient about the risks and benefits of triple therapy with clathrin-bocephavir, I need to also tell them what is coming. Now, if I had that conversation 4 years ago, it was a bit of a, eventually we're going to have new drugs. But at this point, listed on this slide are just regimens in phase three. With cimiprevir and sofosbuvir in combination with peginterferon and ribavirin already filed with the FDA, the action date for the FDA on cimiprevir, a second-generation once-daily proteasome inhibitor, is late November of this year. The action date for sofosbuvir is December 8th of this year. In other words, the FDA will make a decision to approve or not these next-generation antiviral agents. In other words, it's no longer a distant, well, eventually we'll have new drugs. They're actually coming relatively soon. And I won't get into the details, but both sofosbuvir and cimiprevir are once daily agents that do not have anemia, rash, or other side effects linked to them. Now, they will be approved in 14 or late 13 with interferon or ribavirin. So keep that in mind when talking to patients. The interferon-free regimens you see here are a bit later in development. But how do these interferon regimens do? Again, I don't want to get into the details. This is a regimen of a protease inhibitor, NS5A inhibitor, plus a non-nuke, plus ribavirin. Sounds complicated, but it's really 12 weeks of three DAAs, ritonavir to boost the protease inhibitor, and ribavirin. And what you can see with the regimen in treatment-naive patients, if you took all three DAAs plus ribavirin, 97 to 98% SVR for genotype 1, and for those null responders, 12 weeks, all oral, 93%. So this is what's launched the phase three trials. I will provide one major caveat in that cirrhotic patients have been kept out of the phase two trials. So it won't be until later this year we begin to understand how our null responder cirrhotic patient will do. But many people have looked at the 93% SVR for all oral therapy in null responders. And at least on paper, that looks better than the 40% one gets with bocephir or telaprevir plus peginterferon or ribavirin. Certainly more trials are needed, but it's tempered the enthusiasm for triple therapy. Now, there's another regimen that's coming, which is sofosbuvir plus ledipizivir. And this is a little bit of data presented at CROI showing for naive patients that they had 100% SVR with 12 weeks. And for null responders, they also had 100%. Again, this is in phase three clinical trials. So in my mind, if we're going to think about treating a patient today, the first thing I want to know is what the patient's liver disease stage is. We can look at the genotype, we can look at IL-28B, we can talk to the patient, but in my mind, staging the patient's liver disease is the most critical factor. It's akin to getting a CD4 count in HIV. CD4 count's greater than 500, prognosis is good. CD4 count's less than 50, maybe you want to be a little bit more urgent in how you deliver antiretroviral therapy. What's depicted here is the rapidly evolving ways to evaluate the liver. Now, Ken Sherman is going to talk more about the liver, but liver biopsy is the gold standard used since the 1950s to establish fibrosis. We now have serum biomarkers, and on April 5th, 2013, the FDA approved the use of elastography in the U.S., and it will be coming to clinics near you to evaluate liver stiffness. So what we're really trying to do is stage patients and look at the amount of fibrosis. In my mind, patients with minimal fibrosis in 2013 can wait to see how these new therapies evolve. As one gets to the right-hand side with more expansive bridging fibrosis and cirrhosis, I think the urgency of treatment increases. But to be honest, even among my cirrhotic patients, in fact, on Monday afternoon, I saw a patient with cirrhosis, a MELD score of about 7, totally compensated. And I actually thought to myself, well, maybe I'll wait until the next wave of antiviral therapies. Now, 6 months ago, I'd actually written in my note that we would treat with telaprobocephir plus pegylofrinivirine. So in 6 months, my plan shifted a bit as to how I might proceed with treatment. So even among your advanced disease patients, you have to think about how to approach them. But clearly, cirrhotic patients need treatment more aggressively. This is an example of the blood test commercially available, known commercially as FibroSure. It includes these blood tests, alpha-2 microglobulin, haptoglobin, apolipoprotein A1A, bilirubin, and GGT, and it gives you a fibrosis stage. These tests are not perfect. What's listed is some of the reasons why they can be abnormal, but blood tests can be used. We can also use liver stiffness, but this just depicts how to think about it in terms of the need for treatment. The closer, the more you get to Medivir fibrosis stage 4 cirrhosis, the greater the need for treatment. Anyone that's over to the left-hand side, even to the green, in my mind, can wait for therapy. So to summarize, we've covered a lot of different factors that one might consider in the treat or no treat decision. Hepatitis C genotype, IL-28B genotype, they clearly predict response. There are also other factors. Age certainly plays a role. I'm increasingly seeing patients in their late 60s and 70s in my practice. Personal factors, what kind of work, what kind of job, the mindset. Many people I'm talking to today are very concerned about insurance coverage. They ask, well, that doc, those new therapies sound great, but will my insurance company pay for it? Now, obviously, that's not a question I can answer, but my hope is with some of the movement we're seeing with respect to the CDC and the screening recommendations, we will see coverage for these new therapies. But a number of factors go into play, but the two that are most pressing for me in the clinic are liver disease stage and how close we are to more effective, more tolerable therapies along the bottom, novel DAA regimens. So in my mind of where we're going, our current therapy looks a bit like on the left. I think of it like this. We've got a single tree in a forest that we want to cut down. And hepatitis C is that tree. Well, what we've been doing is essentially dropping napalm on that forest. And we take out the tree, but there's a lot of collateral damage. What we're doing in the future is essentially taking a chainsaw and going to cut that tree down. And what we've seen in clinical trials is we can spare patients side effects with higher SVR rates. So clearly, there's reasons to wait when one can as treatment gets better. Now, back to our question, and this will wrap up the discussion. Which of the following adverse effects are associated with both telaprevir and bocephir? One is alopecia, 2 is hematuria, 3 is anemia, 4 is rash, and 5 is neutropenia. Which single adverse event is common to both telaprevir and bocephir? Go ahead and vote. So 93% for anemia. And I think certainly you can see, and that's increased from the 56%. Alopecia is interferon. Hematuria is one of those unrelated to either one. It's true rash can occur on bocephir. It's typically been attributed to ribavirin. And neutropenia really is a bocephir side effect. It wasn't seen in the telaprevir trials. It's also an interferon side effect. So I'll stop there. Thank you.